Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to AI Movie Night. I'm your host, Joe Simpson, and tonight we'll be discussing the 1968 classic, Planet of the Apes. I'm lucky enough to have two great guests to discuss it with. Firstly, I have the returning Martin Fitzgerald, one half of the excellent Ruffin Martin's album and JFK Clubs. How are you doing, Martin?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm very well, thank you. Thanks once again for coming on.
This is the first film I've done which hasn't got Kevin Costner in it.
It is. I think it'll be interesting to see. I've got a feeling your knowledge will dip considerably with the lack of Costner in there, so it'll be interesting to see.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for coming on. I'm also lucky enough to be joined by the host of the main Anfield Index podcast, making his debut on Movie Night, Trevor Downing. How are you doing, Trev?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks very much for coming on, mate. I look forward to hearing both your views and obviously it's a film I love and I know you're both big fans yourselves, so I look forward to hearing what you both think about it. As always, there's so much to cover, so I'm just going to get straight into it. My usual question to start off, when and where you first saw it and what you thought of it at the time, please, Trev.
Ah, well, yeah, I suppose I was probably around 12, 13. The local TV channel were showing the whole sequence of the films on Friday night at about 9:30, 10:00. So it was a kind of a treat for myself and my brother. And we used to, gather up all the goodies and we really look forward to it. You know, my parents had friends around, so we basically moved the little TV, the little remote control into the room, and it was a whole big occasion. But the movie itself, the first one in particular, I just pretty much dumbfounded me, I'll be honest with you. It led to all sorts of pre-stoner conversations that you know that would have been far better facilitated by the aid of some sort of herbs of some sort, but it left just an indelible impact on me, just not only for the ideas in it, which were obviously kind of mind-blowing in and of themselves when you're that age and you're kind of semi-sentient human, you know, you want to engage with that type of thought. And I read lots of comics. I was an avid reader, and 2000 AD was a big one of mine, so science fiction was obviously a very big thing as well. And, you know, the ideas in that were massive, but it also had a big impact on me in terms of, I remember thinking, that's the kind of stuff I'd like to do. And I kind of have tallied with it over the years. I've done quite a bit of acting, and it was one of the formative things for me, actually, on a lot of levels.
Well, that's interesting, that acting aspect. I think I could be wrong here, and I almost certainly am, but I think from what I've read and obviously just watching it itself, I think it's one of the first films where that level of makeup's been able to be used, but the actors have still felt fulfilled and felt able to give, you know, a distinguished and separate performance that stands out as themselves. And, you know, just some of the acting in it, I'm just a massive fan of, and obviously a massive fan of it in so many other ways as well. What about yourself, Martin?
I think I was probably maybe kind of late teens, and I think it was on a sort of weekend maybe, or maybe some sort of holiday period. And you know, my kind of memory of kind of watching Planet of the Apes for the first time was that this was an okay film, mm-hmm. and then the ending happened, and it made me just think about the film in a sort of completely different way. And I think, I mean, obviously we are going to kind of get on to the you know, twist, but I think possibly only up there with kind of Psycho, it's the only film that I know of where the sort of twist, you know, makes everything that came before not only better, but it makes you want to watch the film again. And then every single repeat viewing of the film, you know, becomes a much better experience because you know what happens at the end. And I think sometimes when there's films which rely heavily on a sort of big twist, that it's almost like the punchline to a joke. And if you think of like a film like The Sixth Sense, which I think it's hard to watch that film again and again and again because of sort of that particular twist. Whereas I think with The Planet of the Apes, I think the film's like good. It's kind of okay. It's pretty sort of slow. But, you know, I just kind of watched it a couple of days ago again. And when you watch it again, knowing what you know, it just makes everything entirely different, I think. So I just have a kind of memory of just of kind of being entertained by a film. I didn't think it was a great film, but then the ending happened and it kind of changed everything.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean there. I think you've called that right there. The ending, as you say, sometimes this doesn't happen. It works in the opposite direction, but the ending elevates every single bit of the film and adds so much more to so many of the lines and just so many of the things that are happening in the different scenes. And I remember seeing something recently where apparently the DVD has a photo of the Statue of Liberty bit on the front. And it's just like, come on, at least make the effort. I know obviously it's been used in The Simpsons and stuff, but at least try and hide the ending from people who haven't seen it, because it does, you know, it does make such an impact to your viewing. I think I watched it. I always bang on about this, but I think a certain bit of magic has been lost from films and TV to some extent anyway, in terms of we can access pretty much anything whenever we want. And I think I watched it as a teenager. I just stumbled across it on a Friday night, I think, on BBC One. And I think it may even have already started. And because you had such limited channels, you just, if you saw a film on, half of the time you would just give it a chance anyway, just because it was a film. And I just remember watching it and really, really enjoying it and being sort of taken away to that place. And then, as you say, when that ending happened, the impact on me was massive. I couldn't believe how clever it was, how clever a reveal, and just, as you say, the impact in terms of how it changed the rest of the film was just massive for me anyway, definitely. Obviously, you touched on some of this, Martin. It's over 50 years old and still loved by many. It's got, like, you know, the people who love it are like hardcore. Obviously, I know you wouldn't be one of those people, but I know you like the film. What do you think it makes it so well loved for those people who absolutely adore it?
I don't really know. I mean, I think it's one of those. I don't know if people really love it because it's like a science fiction film. I mean, obviously, it's probably a question for Trevor. He was talking about the sort of impact that it sort of had on him in terms of, I guess, some of the philosophy behind the film. It's a really simple film. There's something weird about it. There's something weird about it in the same way that I think there's something a bit weird about Jaws. And the, as time has kind of gone on, and it's become easier to, you know, use things like CGI and stuff like that, that something's been lost in within films like Planet of the Apes. If you look at that kind of makeup, for example, they don't really look like apes, particularly compared to the sort of modern remakes of sort of Planet of the Apes. But in the same way that the shark in Jaws doesn't really look like, you know, fully functioning shark, and even to the point where they couldn't get the shark to work in Jaws, so they just had to represent the shark with those kind of orange boys. There's something within Planet of the Apes where they're not kind of apes, but they're kind of just, they become their own thing, which is sort of, and it's not really kind of dated within the 60s. There's a kind of charm about it, I think. But I think also it has a sort of look and feel of almost like a Western. There's lots and lots of wide open spaces in it. And really the film sort of takes place in what looks like a sort of relatively small village. But then all around that, you have these kind of huge sort of vistas where, I think it was filmed in Tenerife, where it just looks amazing. It looks, I think that's the trick of the film, is it looks otherworldly, but it's obviously Earth. I could only assume that people like it for the same reasons that maybe I like it, which is that it's such a good punchline, and it makes watching it. I mean, I really enjoyed watching it the other night, and there's nothing I can really. I think there are times where it doesn't sort of elevate itself to sort of brilliance, but at the same time, there's nothing really about it that annoys me or I think is kind of wasted within the film.
Martin's obviously touched on some of the things there, Trev. Obviously, I can tell you're like, obviously from when you were younger and that, you got a lot more into the whole sort of, you know, the things that surrounded the film. And, you know, I can tell that you're more of a deeper fan, shall we say, of the film. Why do you think it's been so enduringly loved by so many people?
Well, if anything, it's grown on me more as the years have gone on. I think Martin is right to talk about, you know, the impact of the ending. That's sort of the one sort of universal thing that everybody can hang their hat on and say, well, look, there's no taking away from that. But I'll be honest with you, as the years have gone on, it's all the stuff around it that I would prefer. And I've really enjoyed even the most recent viewing of it in preparation for this, to see if there's anything that I'd forgotten and I hadn't. You know, it was one of those movies where, even though I've probably only seen it three or four times over the years, but you felt like you could recite every line. The thing for me is the sort of morass of ideas in there. You know, it's remarkable. And if anything, and this would be Martin was trawling about looking for something to say that might be, you know, a reason why it's not 100% a favorite of his. And the only negative I would say is there's probably too many ideas. I mean, you've got ideas of race and caste and slavery and church versus state and religion versus science, and you've got all these kind of archetypal societal discursive points that everybody engages with at some stage if they have a half working brain. Everybody sort of thinks about them on some level, and the film just engages all of those. The only thing I would say that's perhaps a weakness is it takes everything and throws everything at the wall. There's so much going on there in terms of the societal issues amongst the apes, like I say, the caste society within the ape civilization itself, the treatment of the humans like slaves. And there's something about that great cornfield scene, which we'll come on to, which, you know, if that doesn't scream, you know, the hideousness of slavery at you, then nothing does. It hits all these kind of tropes and ideas that we can all sort of, that resonate with all of us. And like I say, I you know, it's like do you know, you have, everyone has a friend who's a kind of a try hard and really kind of gets into stuff with a heart and half and might not necessarily always nail it, but you feel affectionately towards them. And that's how I feel about this film. It's a clever film, and there's no two ways about it. I think it tries a bit too much to be too clever and takes on too many ideas, but I'm never going to fault anything for that. And when you're, like I say, when you're a kid, when you're a teenager, like I was when I revisited it, those ideas are everything to you, and you want to examine them, and you want to experience them, and you want to research them. And it's because of those ideas. Of course, yeah, the ending and all the rest of it, but because of those ideas, I think it endures. And it's never been more relevant, to be fair, Joe. You think about the orange gibbon that we've got across the water, that's, you know, threatening to disrupt mankind. That's a parallel right there.
No, can't argue with that at all. Can't argue with that at all. I think you've hit on something that I tend to think is one of the reasons it's so well loved. It's one of them films that sort of strides two different sort of courses. So you can watch it and take in all those things you've mentioned, you know, like science versus tradition and racism and caste systems and things like that, as you mentioned, so many different things. You can watch it, take those things in and be thinking about those things, but equally it works for many, many people just as well without having, you know, without them doing any of that, just
as a straight up adventure story.
Just a fun film as well. And I do like that it's got both of them things, and I think certainly for myself, depending on what mood I'm in, I can watch it in either one of those ways. Obviously, most of the time, like most people, you're watching it in both ways to a certain extent, but sometimes I can just throw it on and I don't think about any of those things. I just enjoy it as a straight up fun bit of escapism. But as you say, it does also have that other element that gives it an extra depth. One of the things for me as well, it's maybe not as big a deal now that I've seen more films, but when I first watched it, or at least the first couple of times, one of the big things about it that really appealed was the character of Taylor and Charlton Heston's performance, because I don't think at that time I'd ever seen someone who I would expect to be the hero of a film be the way he is, so cynical, and, you know, at times he's absolutely horrible at times to some of those fellow astronauts and things. And there was something about that made a big impression on me, that it's like he wasn't like every other sort of hero you would see in a film of that type. And I don't know, I just absolutely love the character and the performance. So what about yourself, Trev? What do you think of the character and, of course, Heston's performance?
Well, look, I mean, this is a guy who is sort of, again, as I'm growing up, he's on TV most Sunday afternoons. He's either El Cid or he's Ben-Hur or he's Moses. And he's this sort of mythical character in the same way that Marlon Brando has that sort of mythos about him as well. And you just see, there's just people that you see all the time on your TV. And like you say, he is a heroic character, but in this, it's not quite anti-hero, but yeah, the cynicism is really kind of refreshing and you don't see it coming. And yeah, he's a complete arse to people like Landon. You know, he basically derides Landon, tells him he's like a NASA sort of a wasp, you know, a good guy, a kind of goody two shoes, best of your class. But what do you really want? What are you really doing here? And he's questioning everything. But I think there's a lack of logic to Taylor's cynicism. Like he's really very much a misanthrope, but at the same time, you know, he says, yeah, I'm a seeker, you know, and he does have some sort of thing. And his thing is there's got to be something better than man. And I think, you know, Martin spoke about it earlier on about that, you know, lovely sequence. And I think Schaffner, I read somewhere before that he really intended that would be a long and drawn out sequence there with the three boys wandering across the desert. And it was to set the film up and to get the idea of this pilgrimage almost to this place. So the words that come out in that sequence are really important. And when you think about, you know, the things that you said earlier on, Joe, when you think about the little lines that come out, and they have added resonance later on, but he's saying there's got to be something better than man out there, you know, and it's that lovely dramatic irony when you've seen it, because you know what's coming. And you know, better than man, well, that's the whole question of the film. Look, Charlton Heston himself, like I say, he is this sort of larger than life character, and you know, you can't separate out the different parts of him. For me, I think Charlton Heston, like I say, I think Ben Hur, I think Moses, I think that wonderful cameo did in Wayne's World when he talks about, you know, that you know, that lovely to me, that's some of his best work ever. I'll be honest with you, because there's something that's come into him there as an old man, and it came into, in the same way that it came into Johnny Cash as a performer. There's a sort of humility that comes with the age that he doesn't have in this film. In this film, he's what? He's 45. He's every inch a Hollywood star. He's every inch what that means. You're carrying the movie, Charlton. And whatever sort of hamming around you want to do, fella, that's all right by us. So you get like these wonderful sort of cock the head back and laugh and sneering at Landon. You've got this wonderful stuff where he's like, you know, pounding the ground with his fists, and everything, I have to say, is hammy as be Jesus. And, you know, I love Charlton Heston, but that is overacted to within an inch of its life. The whole performance, there's nothing naturalistic about it. It's coming, when you think about it, it's 1968, you know, we're coming out of the era of Jimmy Dean and Brando changing everything. But then you go and you look at movies from that time, you look at those guys, they're just sort of breaking the wall. Naturalism's only coming out, and he's only sort of, and he's even more old school. So I don't know. As a performance, it leaves quite a lot to be desired, apart from the absolute magnetic star quality of it. And, you know, he has to have that because he spends most of it walking around in a loincloth. But you know, at the same time, the character is bloody fascinating, endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, I agree. He's just such an interesting character, and different to anything I'd seen at that stage in a film, no doubt. What about yourself, Martin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just quite rare for Charlton Heston performance that this is almost kind of like almost kind of countercultural Charlton Heston. And I think that if you look at the year that this came out, 1968, so you've got, you know, the Vietnam War, you know, really starting to sort of develop at this point. Nixon gets elected in late 68. There's kind of revolution all across Europe. There's lots of riots within America at the time. Martin Luther King gets shot. Andy Warhol gets shot in 1968. Robert Kennedy gets shot. It's like a big year for the kind of counterculture movement within the States. And you have Charlton Heston playing a character which almost seems like one of those kind of anti-hero sort of performances from the 70s. That you associate with maybe Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro, and those kind of early Clint Eastwood films as well, where his whole thing in this film is kind of anti-authority, and he has all of that stuff with I think it's Julian or Julius, where he keeps on encouraging the sort of the kind of young chimpanzee not to listen to people that are older. And of course, we look at this now and we think, well, you know, Charlton Heston's an old guy. He almost kind of reeks of kind of conservative America. But actually, in this film, you wonder how much appeal this film would have had to people that were kind of dodging the draft, people that were protesting against Vietnam War, because one of the messages that I think would have been more kind of salient at the time, but maybe lost now, is just that the sort of individualism of the film and the lack of respect, not only for the world where he came from, but also the world in which he finds himself in now. And I think that must have kind of resonated to a sort of late 60s audience. But it's weird. It's just weird to have Charlton Heston playing that type of character.
totally agree. And funnily enough, I was watching some of the DVD extras, and I think it was Kim Hunter, it may have been, who basically said the nickname they gave him on set was Charlie Hero. And it's funny because, like, obviously that is, ordinarily, that is exactly who he would play. And I know, obviously, we've said how he's still the hero in this. But some of the things he's coming out with, and like the lack of sort of the lack of compassion or any real sadness for the female astronaut, there's nothing like that. And he's just got contempt for so many things. And one of the things that highlights that, what you're saying about countercultural, particularly in that time, is where he just laughs at the American flag. He's sort of the opposite of, you know, the more of a standard idea of what an astronaut would be. He's like the opposite in this, and I just love that contrast. Obviously, there's so many characters in this who are interested in different ways. Another two of the main characters are Cornelius and Zira. Have you got any thoughts on their characters? I know it sounds really funny talking about monkeys in this way, but have you got any thoughts on their characters or the performances of McDowell or Hunter Martin?
I think before we get on to them, it is important to sort of say about this film, right, that this is a film called Planet of the Apes, right? So that would have already had my attention as a kid, because it sounds like, it's like when there's a really old story about how they were trying to get the funding for Zulu, and the guy who directed Zulu was having a piss once next to this famous producer called Joseph Levine, and he said, "What are you working on at the moment?" And he said, "I'm trying to get this film going about Rorke's Drift, about this battle in South Africa. I'm trying to get funding for it. I'm having a really bad time." And the producer said, "What's it called?" And the director said, "It's called Zulu." And the producer said, "How much money do you want?" Because it was such a great name, right? And I think Planet of the Apes is a bit like that. It's like, there's at that point, there was no other films about a sort of planet full of apes. So once you've got that title, when you watch this film for the first time, and bearing in mind that it is 1968 and it's now 2017, is that you can really mess that up. You could look back on that, you know, maybe like people look back on, I don't know, Thunderbirds or something and go, okay, I see what they were trying to do, but God, it looks naive and it looks cheap now. But, so when you watch it for the first time, and obviously you see the astronauts, you see them walking through the desert, and you must be, there's an element of you where you're thinking, okay, I know there's going to be some apes soon, and maybe you hadn't seen a trailer. These apes better look good, because this film's quite good so far. I quite like the characters. Please don't fuck this up when the apes turn up. And I have to say, to me, like, it's almost better than the ending. Is the key scene in the film, for me, is the bit where they are kind of running through the field, and the apes turn up for the first time. And they're wearing leather waistcoats, and they're on horses, and they've got rifles. And I remember watching that for the first time, and every time I watch the film and that scene comes along, I think, well, they really didn't fuck that up. That's how you make an entrance into a film called Planet of the Apes. And they look really menacing, because those initial apes in the field, yeah, they don't have dialogue and stuff like that, particularly. They just look like they're on horses. It's like it's an animal riding another animal. It's kind of weird and it's kind of scary. The film then obviously develops, and you get to meet the Roddy McDowell character and the female chimpanzee. And without sort of loving either of those two characters, I think that, they don't ruin the film. And they are a necessary part of the film because they are the kind of bridge between Taylor and the apes that run society. And they have so much kind of dialogue and stuff like that. But they're not... They're a little bit cutesy for me. Like, I don't like... If you edited the film, I would do without the scenes where they kiss each other and stuff, which is just seem a little bit silly. But no, they are they're an important part of the film, and they, you know, without them, the film sort of doesn't move forward because they're looking at Taylor from a point of sort of scientific interest, where other people just want to cut his brain out. But I think they're good performances, and I think you watch it now still, and you think, you know, you're kind of not looking for the sort of, you're sort of not looking for the joins. You accept them for what they are. They don't really look like, you know, chimpanzees, but it's fine. It's fine. They don't have to. They work perfectly well as they are.
Yeah, I think you're right there with those, and also with the apes on horseback. I think that's key, isn't it? If they don't work, and obviously the apes, the first ones we see, don't work, then you could quite easily just turn that off.
And I think 100%. You get that scene wrong, and it's film over.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
They got that scene so right. They're terrifying, those initial apes. They're far more kind of menacing, and they have a sort of sense about them, which none of the apes in any of the remakes kind of ever have. There's something, I don't know what it is. I think it's the leather waistcoats, apes in leather. That does it for me.
And as you said before, on the horses, just visually, there's something about that that's really imposing and unsettling as well.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and I think one of the things as well, linked to what we were talking about then, that was the big concern of the producers, that if the apes don't work, then the film is just going to be a bomb, and obviously an expensive bomb at that. And I think they did a screen test with, I think it was Edward G. Robinson as Dr. Zaius. He didn't end up taking the role in the end, but they did a screen test and seen whether it was laughable, essentially. And apparently, because that worked, that gave them the confidence then to go ahead. And obviously, we were talking earlier about some of the themes in this film. You know, it's such an achievement to be able to use apes in a film and be able to have some of these discussions about, you know, different philosophical things, and it work, because as you rightly pointed out, it could have absolutely been laughable, and the idea of any of those things being linked to the film, any of those themes would just be crazy. But because it worked so well, obviously it succeeded massively. What about yourself?
I think just sort of on that, I think it is a kind of blessing in disguise that they probably were nervous about how the apes would come across, because it allows them to work on the script. It allows them to work on all the other aspects of the film that they can control. Mm-hmm. And to sort of compare it to Jaws again, I remember reading once about how he could never get that shark to work, and the film was going over budget and everything. And it was during that time when they were trying to make the mechanical shark work that they worked on a lot of the script for, like, Jaws. So those scenes within the sort of boat where they're talking about their scars and all that sort of stuff, really great moments in Jaws, mm-hmm. they come about because the shark doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I think that you imagine them making Planet of the Apes, and they're sitting there a little bit nervous about the apes, in a way that the people doing the remakes aren't. Yeah. And you imagine them thinking, well, let's just get everything else right.
Yeah.
And then hopefully if we do a decent job with the apes, it'll be fine. So I think that's the blessing in disguise.
Yeah, no, totally agree. It's that whole cliche, but often true, about necessity being the mother of invention, and also sometimes restrictions helping you to sort of be more creative in another way. And I think one of the ones on this it reminds me of is, I think the original plan was to have the apes live in a futuristic city with, you know, flying cars, I think, if I remember right, but definitely a futuristic city. And it was the fact that they didn't have the money to pull that off made them go with what they went with in the end. And I just think that works so much better than the other version would have. Obviously, we'll never know, but my instinct would be they, what they ended up having to do was a much better way of going about it. What about yourself, Trev?
In relation to the makeup and the two characters you mentioned at the start?
Yeah.
Well, to be honest with you, that's a good point that Martin makes, is that initial impression is kind of all important. And when you see, armed gorillas on horseback, that leaves quite the impression on you, no matter what age you are. And if that doesn't work out of the gap, then you're in trouble. And I think the gorillas work better than any of the other apes, just on a technical point. You saw that you refer to that 1966 screen test. I saw it at some stage as well. And I think it's Edward G. Robinson, as you say, and he's got these horrible mutton chops and he's playing Dr. Zaius, and you've got Charlton and he's lounging about in a safari jacket, and then the two chimps come in. I think one of them's Josh Brolin, and then the girl who ends up playing Nova, Linda Harrison, and they only did the bottom half of their faces. they gave $5,000 to this screen test to see how it would go, and I mean, you can imagine the eyebrows getting raised left, right, and center, because I think a massive thing was, like you said, please don't laugh at this, maybe laugh with us if we're doing funny stuff, or like again the phrase that I think Martin used there, the cutesy stuff from Zaius from Zira and Cornelius. Yeah, again, you could do without it. I don't know necessarily does it have any negative effect, because the idea was that you sort of, in an ironic fashion, that you humanize them as much as possible so that they're very, very relatable for people. And, the little kiss or whatever, whether you think it's a little bit much or whatever, I understand the motivation behind it. I get it completely. But that guy who does the makeup for it, the guy who was ultimately responsible, he used to make prosthetics or whatever for army veterans, John Chambers. I mean, he's responsible for Spock's ears, I believe, as well. This is a guy who's created something, genuinely striking. And, again, you can say maybe the chimp one doesn't work as well as the gorilla or the orangutans or whatever. But to me, the two characters, the two actors, they emote, and they said themselves they had to really overact with their faces so that those gestures would come through. And so it is a little bit kind of mimey. It's a little bit the kind of shite I used to see when I went to various acting camps and classes and stuff like that. I never lasted any longer than a week at any of those things, because it was always go over there and be a tree. And I just, at some stage you just want to just slam the door and walk out. And that sort of actory thing came out very, very much from Roddy McDowall and from Kim Hunter. But, they are good actors, the two of them. And Kim Hunter, like last time I'd seen her, was she's Stella, in Streetcar. That's someone who can do the job well. That's someone who knows how to deal with a raging beast in front of them, a guy in a torn top shouting and roaring. She knows how to deal with that. And it was just interesting from that point of view to when you think about the characters. But that's after the event. I have to say it didn't grate with me at all at the start, except that I found their movement a bit mimey, and that was their interpretation of how a chimp moves. Fair enough, but the effects themselves, I think you'd have to say was a sort of a glorious success. And if you remember, this is the same year that 2001 Space Odyssey came out, and I have definitely read reviews of Kubrick's movie where the review centered around, well, to be fair, Schaffner's apes are far better than Kubrick's apes, and it's a better film as a result of it. And people mocking and laughing at that opening section of 2001, which does go on a bit, let's be honest, the Dawn of Man section, not quite the opening section, but the Dawn of Man section. So already Schaffner and the boys here had one up, and I think I think it stood to it. You know, it was like 33 million in the box office at the time, which can't be bad.
Yeah, no, definitely. And as we've said, you know, they may not look like apes, but they're sort of, they capture a certain essence that results in them working. And I think because of that, some of those sort of cutesy bits that I went particularly mad on either, it gets away with them. Whereas if the sort of makeup was poor, then things would, you know, it'd already be sinking, but then things would push it right under. So I think it just about gets away with that because of how good the makeup is.
Well, it's did you suspend your disbelief? You know,
totally.
It's the key question. It always is with a movie that's high concept. Did you suspend your disbelief? And I think from the minute you see the boys on horseback with guns, you've done that, and that's a win.
Yeah.
I think also you have to remember that there's a large section of the film, which looking back on it is incredibly brave. There's a large section of the film where Charlton Heston is, you know, mute. Mm-hmm. So yeah. The only people talking at that point in the film are, you know, apes. Yeah. You've got the only you know, the only sort of human there, and you've taken his voice away from him. Mm-hmm. And which they do to really great dramatic effect when he then talks again the first time. But it seems like such a high wire act that imagine a kind of script meeting where you have the script and then you've only just introduced the apes and it says, and then for the next 25 minutes, you know, Charlton Heston doesn't have any lines.
Yeah, well, that's Martin, that's someone who's really confident in their script, isn't it? I mean, you know, like you say, that's where they start introducing all these ideas, these high concept ideas, like, you know, that, you know, are universal, like religion versus science and the eternal debate. And you've got this lovely irony of the leader of the society happens to be the key scientist, but also the head of the faith. And the contradiction of that becomes slowly apparent. And you get to see this sort of dissension in the ranks with Zira and Cornelius. And it's a strong script because, like you say, you're looking at a lot of apes talking here, and it could have become farcical.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a really good move that they kind of muted him for that 20-25 minutes, because it does allow you as the audience to kind of just go through the same thing that Taylor's going through, where you're sort of understanding what's going on within this, you know, society. And just from a very simple point of view, you can see that there's kind of three types of apes. There's they're baboons, there's gorillas, and there's chimpanzees. And to give the script over to them for 20-25 minutes is, and it just totally works. It totally works. But it must have been a kind of brave thing to do.
Yeah, you can imagine a producer, can't you, putting so much money in for this big star, and then, as you say, he's not speaking for 25 minutes, and the film's got to be, to some extent anyway, carried by the apes. It does seem such a risk, but like you've both mentioned, it works so well because we're in his shoes, and the frustration he has is building in us, because we want him to be able to show what he can do, that he can speak and that he can think, and, you know, and it's good because it really puts you in their shoes. And just, you know, I love that part of the film, and as you so rightly say, Martin, when he finally does get to speak, it has so much more impact because we haven't heard him speak for so long. Obviously, one of the other things that's so memorable about the film is the score by Jerry Goldsmith. What did you make of the score, Trev?
Yeah, it's particularly good because it's so jarring, I think, you know. Now, let's be honest, at that time, you know, you've an awful lot. I was watching Bullet there recently, and I watched something else. I think I watched the Thomas Crown Affair as well recently, and it was an era of sort of mad, unusual soundtracks and experimental music, and this is experimental as be Jesus, and deliberately so. But I think the word that I'd use is jarring, and in much the same way as I went to see Dunkirk lately, and an awful lot of people had the hump about that. I don't understand that. And then myself, I thought it was tremendous on a lot of fronts. But one of the things that worked was the fact that Zimmer didn't do his usual sort of heaving strings and stuff like that. This was noises and syncopated sounds and rhythms and sort of awkward, jarring soundscapes. And there's a lot of that with Jerry Goldsmith's soundtrack as well. I suppose the most memorable parts are you know, the cornfield sequence in particular. I think that has certain little sounds and sound effects that, you know, everyone remembers, and they're the ones that they ape, if you'll excuse the horrible pun, in The Simpsons when they're doing a homage stroke satire of it. So, you know, I think it worked really well in that it left you a bit unsettled. And I read somewhere, I can't remember now, but he deliberately used unusual instruments as well. You know, there was some sort of a ram's horn and various bits and pieces like that. So I think it made a real sort of impact in terms of echoing the themes of uncertainty and being unsettled. And then, of course, the lovely build up to the big scene, which I presume we'll talk about eventually. I think that worked very well as well.
And yourself, Mark?
I think you kind of, you know, nailed that, Trevor, there. I don't think it's ever kind of music that you would sit at home and listen to. It isn't a soundtrack, but it is these sort of moments of kind of noise that seems so at odds with, I guess, what you would normally have within, particularly a lot of Westerns, I think, is when you're having those big kind of landscapes and those kind of huge sort of vistas, there's lots of kind of strings. It's very, you know, elegant. And this is the opposite of that. It sounds like at times, you know, people are kind of just in the background, kind of, you know, dropping huge panes of glass. And so it's kind of weird in that respect, but it does give the film a sense of this isn't quite what it seems. There's a sense within, I think, the entire film, which I think the sort of soundtrack really adds to it, is a sense of kind of foreboding and kind of otherworldliness about it, which is kind of unsettling. There's something, you are unsettled throughout. And I think the soundtrack does a lot to achieve that.
Yeah, completely agree with you both. I think, as we mentioned earlier on, obviously the locations used are obviously Tenerife and places like that. And I think what's really good about the score, as you both mentioned, is that sort of unsettling, otherworldly part of it helps to sort of sell this as another planet in a really good way, and also gives you that, as you say, I think it's over half an hour before we come to any apes in the film, but that gives you that, as you say, that constant sense of foreboding. Obviously, you know, the apes are coming, but it makes the planet even more sort of scary and unsettling than it would be just off knowing the apes are coming, just because it's, you know, those sort of noises and then things like the scarecrows really put you on edge in a really good way. Obviously, I'm aware of the time, so I'm just going to, we would normally go through a few of the scenes, but instead of that, I'll probably just ask you both if there's, other than the end scene that we'll look at in a moment, are there any other scenes that particularly stand out for you, please, Martin?
I think the sort of big scenes for me are the introduction of the apes, which I've mentioned. I really kind of like the scenes with Dr. Zaius where, you know, you as the audience kind of know that he's sort of on to something and that he is more aware than anyone else. So you do start to think, well, what's he, you know, scared of? You know, why are they so scared of Taylor? So I think the scene where Taylor writes in the sand and then he has that fight and... you know, Dr. Zaius sees that Taylor has been able to write in the sand, but then he kind of rubs that out. I think is a good scene in the sense of, you know, you get to see something as the audience that the rest of the characters in the film don't quite yet know. And of course, this then gets explained when they go out to the forbidden zone and they go to that cave. And I just think, like, I really like that whole scene within the cave where, you know, and at this point, I have not worked out the ending because I'm not, you know, I just enjoy films within their moment. But there's a sense of, okay, so this entire time, you know, Dr. Zaius has known about this cave and the kind of doll and the sort of false teeth, and there's been and he's been hiding that, and then of course he tries to blow the cave up. So I think just that sense of, you know, without it kind of giving the ending away, there's a few scenes within the film where it's sort of painting a little picture, even when he kind of gets the paper airplane and he crumples it up. It's constantly telling you there's something going to happen here, and like, this guy knows what it is. I think they're the scenes that I think are the sort of really sort of stick with me.
Yeah, love all those bits and Zaius's character, and you know, I love that line as well where he basically says, "You may not like what you'll find," and it's sort of, you know, the showing the full extent of his knowledge of what's to come for Taylor, and just a very interesting character, and, you know, some great scenes you mentioned there. What about yourself, Trevor? Is there any scenes we haven't touched on that stand out for you at all?
Yeah, well, it's kind of moments, isn't it? I suppose in terms of moments, one thing that always stayed with me is I love that little scene where, and it's almost like a throwaway detail, where the gorillas have decided to take a photo of their prey that they've caught, like the great white hunter type traditional pig that we've all seen with the old-fashioned camera, and even just that kind of, you know, feel of the old tech. You know, nothing. There's no real logic to that whole society in terms of how they drew it together, and there's no timeline to it that makes any sense at all. But it just kind of works for some strange reason. Like the idea of a camera, that particular type of rifle, the fact that they're on horseback, the fact that they're living in some, you know, actual based on a troglodyte Turkish village that actually exists. None of those things kind of add up. But then you see those little moments, and that one really stood out for me. It was something I loved the sledgehammer irony of it. I liked as well the little scene between Zaius and is it Lucius at the end, where, you know, it's kind of, Lucius is there, like Martin referred to earlier on, that kind of he's been spurred on by Taylor's sort of iconoclastic, you know, that don't trust anyone over 30, all that stuff, and Lucius says something like about what is it, you know, why must knowledge stand still, or something like that? What about the future? And Zaius just goes, "I think I may have just saved it for you," you know. And I love that as well, because, you know, it kind of, it foreshadows the idea of these guys are dangerous and I'm keeping you safe. And I suppose the big scene that we didn't refer to much that really had the essence of all those ideas I spoke about right back at the start was that courtroom scene. I loved all that. I loved the idea of the statue of the lawgiver in the background, the sacred scrolls, and talking about the forbidden zone and all that. And it's got all those kind of stereotypes of religion. Everything that you see in any religious paradigm is there. And it's just, that really spoke to me, I have to say, and made me start asking questions about, you know, I was brought up as a really traditional Catholic. And even from that stage, you start asking funny questions, but really, like, this seems like a story. And you see all the parallels with other stories. And I have to say that resonated very, very strongly with me. And, you know, even at one stage, Zaius calls Cornelius an apostate. And, you know, having seen Scorsese's little movie there recently as well, all these things kind of come together in your head. So, yeah, that was very powerful for me in terms of those ideas that we spoke about before.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of that trial scene as well. And, you know, there's something powerful about it, particularly when you first watch it and seeing, you know, like any sort of belief taken to extremes. It was so powerful seeing, you know, how little anything he had to say meant to them. No matter what he said, he couldn't win. You know, when you watch it for the first time, you're hoping he can talk his way to get some sort of reason from these people, or should I say orangutans, I don't know, but, you know, you're hoping that he can sort of reason with them. And it just becomes clear right throughout that trial scene that there is nothing he can say or do that will in any way reach them, because their level of fear, and they just don't want to believe. And obviously in Zaius's case, he knows the real truth. And
that's why it resonates so much, like, you know, with audiences who watch it today, because all around the world you've all these, you know, just, you know, ideologies, these, you know, everyone got their own version of a story that they believe in, and these really firm ideologies, and this hatred and this intolerance that we see everywhere, and all of those themes are there shouting at you from that film. You know, and of course they would be, because, you know, you're not far out of, you know, Bay of Pigs and Cuban Missile Crisis and Reds Under the Bed and Duck and Cover and all that kind of nonsense, and here we are again. Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Did you know there's a weird thing that the actors that were made up as orangutans, and the actors that were made up as gorillas, and the actors that were made up as chimps, when they weren't like filming, when they were just having some downtime, they all kind of hang out together in their own kind of ape species. This is true. It wasn't planned. It just happened that way.
Were they going method, do you think, Martin?
So all of the orangutans kind of just sort of hung out with each other. And all the chimpanzees hung out with each other. Right. And I think if you're making that film and you're walking into the canteen and it's like an orangutan table and a gorilla table, I think you're thinking, what the fuck's going on?
Well, here's a question for you, Martin. Where would you go? I think the gorillas would be great lads.
I think, you know, I think it's like, if I could have any part in this film, I said it's the first gorilla on the horse. That's like a, I mean, you'd not be known for it, but what a part that would be. But it is weird that like talking about some of the themes of the film that I guess unbeknown to the sort of actors, they're then kind of playing that out.
Yes,
and they're just hanging around with like, so there was no cross-pollination of the ape species amongst the actors when they were just hanging out between takes. That's pretty weird.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because I know obviously in a lot of films they sort of encourage that type of thing to build up sort of enmity or differences within groups. But as you say, with it coming about completely naturally, it just takes it to another level, doesn't it? It's just fascinating about, you know, just so human that we just naturally put ourselves into certain groups, and then that changes things. And now it's fascinating that, and I must say that reminds me of. It's also one of them films that I think this is another reason why it's so popular with the people who absolutely adore it. It's one of them films that's got a great story behind it as well, you know, in terms of how it came to be made and behind the scenes stuff like that. And I think that's definitely part of it.
I think it kind of reminds me of like various England squads where the sort of Liverpool players would all hang out and the United players would all hang out. You know, there's a lesson in Planet of the Apes, which, I don't know, England might have won some more tournaments.
They need more gorillas.
Had people followed that lesson. Maybe that's what they should do in the World Cup. Just watch Planet of the Apes first.
I think you've hit on something.
I mean, it is unorthodox, Joe. I'll give you that. But, you know.
We may as well try anything. It. Yeah.
Why not? What's the problem?
Yeah, try everything film. Else.
What's the worst that's going to happen? Then you've got to watch a good film.
Love it. I'm glad you've mentioned that, because, you know, in terms of humour and things, that's another thing from the film that, as well, obviously it's quite a serious film, but there are, you know, obviously you've mentioned most of the scenes I would have mentioned, but I like the little bits of humour, like there's a bit where at the trial, I think the three orangutans do the expressions of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, little things like that, or, you know, where they'll say lines like, you know, human see, human do, little bits like that. It's just got a little bit of everything, this film, for me. Obviously, we've mentioned it so much, that ending of the film, And you've touched on it a little bit, both of you, but obviously it's so iconic. What are your thoughts on that ending, Trev? And did it take you unawares the first time, or had it been spoiled? Or
no, well, I was too young and naive to have had an internet free to have had any exposure to it all. So I was a perfect candidate for the ending blowing me away, and that's why I was stressing early on that, of course, that's incredible, and it hits you right between the eyes. But all the other ideas in it stayed with me as well, you know. But the ending itself, like, I mean, yeah, it's iconic in every single way that you can imagine. The cinematography is really interesting, kind of inventive with the zooms and the pans across the torch and the spikes on the crown and everything like that. And it's tremendous. You ally that to the soundtrack, and then the big reveal, and of course it's stunning. It's stunning cinema. It's a moment of stunning cinema, and you'd expect no less from, you know, a writer who's been responsible for, in Rod Serling, who's been responsible for so many fantastic moments of shock and future shock in his TV show, which we'd be well aware of. But I think the thing with me about this key scene, and I'm just to be a bit contrary about it, is that ironically, every time I see the film, it's the thing that kind of impresses me less and less. And it's not because of a lack of impact. All those other things are wonderful. But we get down to the end of it, and I come back to El Chuckles himself. And there's something about that performance, you know, that I used to do a kind of a piss take of it myself back in the day, just for the crack, to entertain people, because I had a very decent impression of El Chuckles Heston at one stage. And I get down the ground and do the whole fist beating into the sand thing, and, you know, God damn you all to hell. And it's just so ham that, you know, it's kind of hard to have the full weight of it ever happen again. The first time I saw it, oh man, it's so powerful. Probably the second time too, but after that, all I could see was, in a kind of arrogant way, yeah, I'd do better than Chuckles there, I think, you know. But you know, that's just by the by. Yeah, no, but look, it's an iconic moment in cinema history. For it has everything, the combination of the what you see, of the sort of bravura aspect of the cinematography, and the soundtrack, and the acting, and the reveal. It's a perfect storm.
I'd echo that. What about yourself, Martin? I know obviously you've touched on it earlier on, but I take it from what you were saying, it clearly took you unawares, that ending.
Yes, I had no kind of knowledge, I think, of the end of the film. I mean, I kind of watched it sort of pre-internet and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So I think I was just sort of dawdling along watching the film, as I said, and then the sort of ending happened. And you know what, you just hope that, you know, similar to sort of Psycho, you just hope that people watch that stuff and that those kind of spoilers just don't sort of seep through, because there is something kind of great about sort of coming to that for the first time and having no idea that that's going to happen. And they sort of they kind of do it so well. I mean, it is, I think it's sort of similar to the kind of shower scene in Psycho, in that it is a moment in cinema, which, you know, I've seen that ending many, many, many times, and they just do it, I think, really perfectly, where, you know, he thinks that he's riding off into the sunset, you know, with his girl. And he thinks he's kind of won. And you have this soundtrack kind of telling you that maybe he hasn't. You have the words of Dr. Zaius, where, you know, he's already said that I don't think he's going to like what he finds and all that sort of stuff. So for a couple of minutes, you are thinking, what the fuck's going to happen here? What can you possibly... Again, it comes back to, I think, some of the kind of bravery of the film, is they've set that up, and you're like, well, what on earth could he possibly find round the corner which is going to make all of this worthwhile? All of the sense of foreboding and the I've just saved you from the future and all of this sort of stuff. And it's just simply the Statue of Liberty. That's it. And but the way they show it, by the little glimpse of the torch first, then the kind of spikes. And at that point, you don't, I don't know, I mean, I can't remember exactly when, but I don't think it's quite clear at that point that it is the Statue of Liberty. Of course, when you watch it back now, you're like, okay, I know what this is. But just the fact that the statue is then sort of submerged into the ground, it's kind of sunken. And I can't think of any other sort of, you know, monument from Earth that they could have used that would have had the same effect. So not only did they choose exactly, I think there were like three endings that they could have had, but I'm not sure what the other two were. But they definitely chose the right one, and they did it in a way which I think was just sort of perfectly done in its sort of gradual reveal. And it's just it's something that everyone can recognise, and it's and at that point you just kind of get what's happened before he even says the "you blew it up, you fools" and all of that sort of stuff, and you're like, fuck, what have I just watched for the last 1.5 hours? He's been on Earth the whole time. Fucking hell. I think it's just a great, great ending. It sort of elevates the film into a much, much better film. And I don't know if we've got time to talk about the sequels, but I don't think the sequels are in of themselves great films. But it's that ending and what it reveals that does then make you watch them and think, okay, well, I would like to know a little bit more about how this happened and this whole, you know, it kind of gives everything a new lease of life, the film that you've just seen and the sequels that you're about to sit through.
Yeah, no, totally agree. I think that's a great place to end, really. But I've got one last thing to say. Trev mentioned, you know, one of his friends earlier on, and I can remember a guy I worked with, and sometimes you have like this people who just see things in a different way to everyone else. And I'm someone, obviously, like yourselves, I love my films, I get wrapped up in them, and sometimes I take them too seriously or things like that. And I was in a conversation once with a few people, and the ending of this film came up, and I was asking again, you know, was everyone, you know, surprised by the ending? And, you know, when someone says something that just takes you unawares, and this guy piped up, he goes, it was obvious they were on Earth. And I was like, why was it obvious they were on Earth? And he went, well, why would they all speak in English?
Yeah,
and I don't know why it's always tickled me since then. You know, sometimes people just see something in a different way. But
yeah, he had it sussed.
Yeah, it sussed.
I think that those people that try to guess endings, and those people that think they're like above the twist, and they are the worst people in the world, and they shouldn't be watching films.
Yeah,
they should not be watching films. You just have to just enjoy that stuff.
Exactly.
And there's nothing to be superior about by. I'm not saying this is what your friend did.
No.
Your friend sounds a bit mad. but there are people who watch a film like this and they take it as a challenge to see if they almost don't like the idea that the film will get one over on them. And that's what the film's trying to do, and you should play your part in that by just enjoying the film.
Yeah, no, totally agree. Well, I'd just like to thank you both for coming on and giving your time. I've loved talking to you both. Where can people find more of your work, Martin?
About the Planet of the Apes. I have no idea.
Rami Club.
I have a book that's coming out on September the 7th. You can just Google that. It's called Ruth and Martin's Album Club, and it's by me, Martin Fitzgerald. You can do that. You can buy that book. That would be good. If not, you can follow me on sort of Twitter or just follow me. I live in Nottingham. You can just follow me around Nottingham if you want.
And, that's not something you want to put out there on a card, Martin.
I mean, it depends. It all depends, Joe, who these people are, you know. But yeah, that's, I mean, basically buy the book. That's a good start. Or don't.
Fair play. I'd thoroughly recommend, I don't know, if anyone hasn't read either Ram Albin Club or Ram JFK Club on the internet, they should check them out. Absolutely excellent work. And I'm sure the book will be more of the same, if not even better, if that's possible. What about
it's possible,
yourself?
Joe, it's possible.
I like it. I like it. That's what I like to hear. And yourself, Trev?
Just get over to AnfieldIndex.com. I'm basically sort of, unfortunately, everywhere. God love them at the moment. I'm hosting the main show. I'm hosting Match Review with Jan Malby. I'm doing an interview show. Again, there's one out with Malby, a two-parter recently that I'm very, very happy with and very proud of. And the man himself's a gem. Yeah, all over that. I do my own AI Audible show where I read the articles of the writers on the website. So there's a lot going on, Joe, that if people want to get to, they'll get all the links on Twitter, on Anfield Index, or on Danny Trev on Twitter as well.
Yeah, thoroughly recommend all of those things, and in particular that Jan Malby interview. You know, where else can you get someone who's been in the Daglish era in the 80s, but also at Ajax with the likes of Cruyff, Van Basten and Rijkaard, and it's just a great interview. So please give that a listen. And if you'd like to check out any other episodes of Movie Night, you can either you'll get them on my Twitter at JoeSimpson79 or at AI Movie Night, and they're all on the AI app. So thanks very much, everyone, for listening, and thanks again to my two guests.
Oh my God, I'm back. I'm home all the time. Finally. Really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up! Oh, damn you! God damn you all to hell!
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.